From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made yesterday when the CEOs of Facebook, Twitter, and Google joined U.S. senators for a hearing over how they moderate content. There were some fireworks. Senator Ted Cruz wanted to ask Jack Dorsey, "Who the hell elected you?" Well, the hearing became heated when lawmakers raised questions about that spread of what they call misinformation, or voting and election interference, or free speech, and more. The hearing was supposed to focus on Section 230. That's a set of federal laws that prevent social media sites from being held liable for content they allow or remove from their sites. Democrats and Republicans differ on where they stand regarding how and to what extent the companies should patrol their sites. And the companies' decisions are fluid. Recently, for example, Twitter blocked an unsubstantiated New York Post piece about Hunter Biden, later reversing its decision and allowing users to share it. All of this may sound a little wonky or like a partisan debate, but the decisions that social media companies make about how they regulate or don't regulate content affects you. It affects all of us. This is about access to information, both verified and unsubstantiated. It's about free speech. In some cases, it's about privacy. In the last couple of months alone, there have been numerous examples of these issues causing controversy, or at the least, questions. And we're going to take a look at many of them in what has been a very busy month for those analyzing social media and the law, and what's allowed, and what is a good idea versus a bad idea. Scott Maloof is an attorney whose practice focuses on the intersection of social media and the law, and that has probably made you busier than ever. Nice to have you back on the program, Scott.
Well, hey, Evan. Thanks for having me.
Hey, who the hell elected you, Scott Maloof?
Definitely not my wife.
Oh, my God. What a start, sir. Well, that's what Ted Cruz wanted to know to Jack Dorsey. Essentially, the senator from Texas was saying, you are acting with way too much power to stop the flow of information. You need to take your hands off the controls. I'm curious to know, first and foremost, what you made of some of those exchanges.
Yeah, it's frustrating because it's important for these issues to come out. Not a good forum for that to happen. One, so close to the election.
Yeah.
You know, it's outside the norm, and at least one of the senators had mentioned that. But two, very difficult because as I was preparing for today and thinking about this, there's so many aspects of social media that we use it for, whether it's just my personal posts or ads that are served to me or organizing groups. And questions like that from the senator are very difficult to get into and dig into the nuance. They're great at being outraged, but not really good at working through how should this work, how should this not work. Because clearly there's always been content that is a public policy we think should not be spread, even obviously in the days of paper, you know. And there's other content that we freely allow. So now we have to get into the weeds, and it's not really helpful to just pick on one person and say, who elected you? In reality, this is really all about all of us and what we do.
Well, and before we get to Section 230, I want to talk a little bit about that the Hunter Biden story from the New York Post that is a couple of weeks old now. And so essentially what happened was Rudy Giuliani had some materials that he wanted to share, and he admitted later that he wanted to share it with a news site that wasn't going to take a whole lot of time trying to verify it, that was going to trust it and publish it. And so he settled on the New York Post. They, of course, did that the very next day. And there were all kinds of weird and wild allegations. I actually like what Anne Applebaum recently wrote, where she said, we're not even supposed to understand the Hunter Biden allegations. They're just supposed to sound really dark and nefarious. But the story was out there from the New York Post. And Twitter decided that it was going to be blocked, that it was not going to be a shareable story on account of the fact that it was really explosive in its allegations that were utterly unverified. And that, I think, is part of what Senator Cruz was talking about yesterday, Scott. My own personal view as a journalist is I thought the New York Post did a shoddy job of reporting. I also don't like Twitter saying you can't share that story. I mean, I'm uncomfortable with that because I don't know where we draw that line eventually. This is different to me than hate speech or other sort of contested forms of posting. This is a news story, ostensibly a news story anyway, that I'm not sure I want Jack Dorsey deciding if we can share it or not. And I'm curious to know how you see it.
Yeah, I agree. That's the real issue here is there's a lack of transparency when these organizations, Twitter and Facebook, who are the biggest ones, the most primary ones, when they take stuff down, when they block things, when they allow it. And I think that Fields generates a lot of frustration, and this story was a really good example of that. You know, people were trying to share it, both through tweets and through direct messages, and they just couldn't. And they cite the hacked messages policy. But later, they go back and say, no, you know, it didn't violate that particular policy. And I think that generates a heck of a lot of frustration, especially when I believe Sundar Pichai, the head of Google, had said, yeah, you know, our organizations do have a lot of folks whose political sympathies lean left. And so when you have that lack of transparency, you can see how someone would say, wait a minute, who inside is advocating for my view? And how could you do it? Another thing, though, I will give Twitter credit. You know, they admitted this was difficult. They tried to do things quickly. But in the past, one of the things they've really done is put information around information or try to contextualize information, such as stories about, you know, mail-in ballots are not going to be received, right, which is not correct. And mail-in ballot is very reliable. Twitter, Facebook, others have tried to say, when somebody posts that, we're going to give you additional information to say, this is really not credible, and this is why. Same thing with COVID stories. So I think there are better ways to do it, and they're just flat-out banning it, you know, highlighted a lot of the problems when you have really heavy-handed moderation. And by the way, when I say moderation, the idea is content goes on and somebody has to make a decision, does this content stay up or does this content go down?
Well, Scott, Senator Cruz asked Jack Dorsey, if Twitter has the ability to influence elections, I want to ask you if you think that question even makes sense, because I think everything has the ability to influence an election. I mean, a news story does, a newspaper does, Twitter does, Facebook does, Joe Biden does, Donald Trump does. I don't understand even the question, but Dorsey, by the way, answered no, saying that Twitter is just one platform that's part of a spectrum of channels that people have. I don't know if he was sort of trying to defend himself against what he perceived as the premise of what Senator Cruz, I mean, sort of the subtext seemed to be, are you trying to influence elections? Are you trying to skew it one way or another? I don't even know what the utility of that question was. Do you?
No. It's very difficult. And it also is something that we always do. You know, and I say we, I mean, when we discuss these issues as a group, you know, we focus just on social media. We just focus on the internet. And we fail to look at the complexities of the real world. There's cable news, there's obviously radio, there's local TV news, there's print publications, there's just people communicating. And I think we make a big mistake when we just put all our eggs in this basket. You know, you and I, before the show, we talked about the documentary, The Social Dilemma. And it was a documentary on Netflix talking about how these platforms had been designed to generate attention, to keep people engaged with them. And one of the things that left me lacking or that I felt the documentary lacked was it didn't talk about all the other things in people's lives, you know? So I think that's a really important thing to point out, that yes, these things are very important, but they're not the only thing going on.
Well, when Joe Biden spoke to the New York Times back in, I guess it was last winter when they were doing their endorsement process, one of the questions that came up was about big tech, and Biden sort of almost offhandedly said, yeah, and we should scrap 230. Charlie Warzel writes for the New York Times as a tech writer, and he just wrote last week saying, to this day, he hasn't gotten the clarification from the Biden campaign if they stand by that, what he meant or why. He would love a follow-up, hasn't heard. Let's talk about what 230 is. Help people understand it first, Scott.
Sure. So what Section 230 is first off, it's a federal law, and it's Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. It was passed back in, I believe, 1996, so at the dawn of what we would think of as the modern internet. And before this law was passed, you still had people using the internet. You had things like, you know, messaging boards, and on those, someone could comment. So let's say, you know, Evan Dawson goes on to a messaging board and he's like, Scott Maloof is, you know, the absolute worst person. He makes terrible chocolate chip cookies, right? And let's say I'm super proud of my cookies. So, you know, one of my recourses would be, sure, I can sue Evan, assuming I can identify him and Evan's used his real name. Or maybe I can say, I'm going to go sue the platform because I bet Evan doesn't really have much in the way of resources, or maybe I can't find Evan, or it's just going to be a lot more useful. So before 230 existed, this was a possibility, and this had occurred. And so the rules that kind of evolved from that, a couple of different cases, were that, you know, if a platform, if the internet organization like Facebook were pretty hands-off, then they wouldn't be liable for the speaker. But if they moderated the speaker, if they went in and said, hey, Evan, you know, chocolate chip cookies, man, they're off the nobody, we're not talking about those, then they might be liable. So, you know, that generates kind of a bad incentive, which is, well, just don't do anything. Well, if you don't do anything on the internet, on these kinds of any of these platforms, you get a lot of terrible things. You get spam, you know, millions of ads because they're free to post. There was an attorney who part of his disbarment was he was one of the first people to post a spam ad. And as part of some of his behaviors, they cited this as, hey, this is a behavior that's a problem. You get viruses, right? People's computers can be infected. And you get a lot of distasteful content. You may have pornography. You may have people with hateful speech or speech that's just really ungenerous. So the idea was you pass this law, and this is going to protect the platforms and let them grow and moderate what happens. So that's the general idea. And we can add more detail if you want.
Well, I guess I want to know what you think we're going next with this and what it portends.
Yeah. Interestingly, right, you implicitly went there in the sense of bipartisanship on both sides saying, I want to see changes to this particular law. Folks on the right saying, you know, there's bias against conservatives, and folks on the left saying, well, we want to attack what we perceive as misinformation, or we want hateful content, maybe on race or disability, to calm down. And so both sides are proposing, and there are a variety of different suggestions about how to change 230. And so where are we going is a question of, you know, what do people want to do? Facebook came out and said, you know, we support some of the changes, and, you know, a lot of other folks had pushed back and said that's not really good. Personally, I think for the most part, the law works as intended, and it's not a particularly smart move to change it with the, you know, in my own personal view, the only real big exception I would make is for international shipment of goods for uses by consumers. So if I buy a leash for my dog from someplace overseas and it's defective and it breaks and it shatters my eye, you know, it may be really hard for me to sue the company that made that. And it would be easier for me to maybe look at the intermediary, say it were Amazon, and say, I'm going to bring a claim against you. And there have been some cases that have looked at that issue, and that may be an exception that the case law is creating in 230. So that's kind of the landscape. There's a lot of competing proposals. Both sides agree they want something, but they don't really agree why or what it would be.
Right.
Go ahead.
Well, I just kind of want to ask you to kind of elaborate on the point that you make there, because you're right. On the political right and left, there are complaints about social media companies, but the complaints tend to fall under different categories. According to CNN yesterday, Republicans have been pointing to Twitter's inaction on tweets from Iranian Ayatollah Khamenei as a way to illustrate, in their view, the uneven application of the company's moderation policies. And Senator Cory Gardner said, quote, it's strange to me that you flagged the tweets from President Trump, but you have not hidden the Ayatollah's call to wipe Israel off the map. Mm-hmm. And so there's a couple things here. I think I want to know if you think it's even possible for social media companies to regulate or moderate equally, given the fact that human beings have biases. So Jack Dorsey's got biases. The people he employs have biases. They might be more concerned about Donald Trump than what's happening in other countries, or what, you know, ostensibly hate speech may be elsewhere. Is there ever a way to achieve an even-handed moderation policy of news, of content, of tweets on social media?
Well, first off, perception, right? Anytime your speech or speech you'd like is taken down, whether it's online or it's in an employment context or it's in a print publication, you feel wronged. And so that's the first issue. People are always going to see something and say, I like that speech, that should be up. But other stuff, I don't like that other stuff, that should be taken down. So that's the first problem. Secondly, a lot of those questions don't look at an underlying truth, which is sheer volume. I took a quick look yesterday. There are 350 million photos uploaded to Facebook every day. Now, let's just assume that, you know, only 20% of those photos are in the United States, so that we might regulate.
Mm-hmm.
So that's still 70 million photos. We're not counting posts. We're not talking ads. We're not talking videos. We're just talking photos. 70 million photos in 24 hours. And guess what? You were sick yesterday, so now there are 140 million photos that you got to look at. The volume is huge. And so people saying, well, this one particular tweet was taken down or this post was left up, you know, you're failing to see it's a huge volume that has to go through. Secondly, the workflow. Yes, there are human moderators, but there's also technology at work, such as AI, such as hashing of images. What a hash of an image is a digital fingerprint. This particular image should not be posted. It comes up a lot with child pornography. And so those tools are in place to use it, and they're automated, you know. And finally, it's context. It's very difficult for even a human who has 10 seconds to review something, or especially for a computer tool or an artificial intelligence tool, to understand context. How has this come up? You and I have talked about it in the past. Someone may receive or see a racist message. And so they complain about it and say, this person sent or this person posted this racist message. The complainant then has their complaint taken down by Facebook. Or, you know, it said, your complaint violates our terms. Okay, and the complainant is incensed, understandably, and it's because it's such a difficult thing. This isn't to let them off the hook, but it's to say, because of the volume, because of context, it's incredibly difficult to do. You know, where your question said, you know, it assumed that Jack Dorsey was sitting there looking at every single tweet. That probably hasn't existed since, you know, 6 or months or a year into his company. So it's really easy to just pick one particular message and say this stayed up, and say this is a proof of bias. It's a different question to look at it systemically and say what's really going on here. And as to the human element, yeah, it's always going to be very difficult, because once you start moderating, once you censor anything, every single person is incentivized to game that system. Hey, you moderated content X. Well, our content, we're group Y. We're really concerned about Y. Y is a lot like X. How come you don't moderate it? And so it only goes one way, which is take down more. And that I think, is probably something we're seeing experimented with in Europe, where they have much more robust requirements for things to be taken down.
Andrew emails to say, what about Twitter blocking President Trump's comments about the coronavirus that are untrue or filled with misinformation? Is that relevant here, Scott?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I really appreciate it. So this brings up a really good issue, which is the difficulty in even saying, can I assess what's going on here? So take COVID or coronavirus, right? It's a medical issue. We can look at it and we can say, is this tweet or this post, is it true based upon the science we have right now? Yes, no, and of course, I think it's likely that these things may start falling into certain groups. Okay, here's a treatment, or masks are, you know, this effective, or things like that. So it is understandable why they might take something like that down, because it was a very narrow issue, corona, and it could be verified yes, no, based upon our best scientific information. And then secondly, you know, finally, all right, does this really serve a purpose, you know, he's the president. If he's commenting on interest rates or he's commenting on policy, you know, maybe we leave it up. And that's been Twitter's default for world leaders. But if it's something like this where it's very narrow, maybe we take it down, especially because he does post so much and he has so many other areas. They may say, you know, looking at the volume and the zeitgeist, taking down this one particular thing when it may be replaced, you know, 10 minutes later by something else is not particularly awful. But as you can see, it took me, 3 minutes to get through that? And if we expect a human, you know, to get through it in 10 seconds, it's going
to
be hard.
Well, thank you, Andrew. And Joel follows up via email to say, Evan, it seems that nearly everybody is forgetting the fact that Twitter, Facebook, etc. are private enterprises, not government entities. The fact that they are so large and ubiquitous does not change that fact. As private enterprises, these companies can do nearly whatever they want with their own platforms. If they felt like it, they could shut themselves down tomorrow and just close up shop. They could change their algorithms and layouts so everything looks different and chaotic. Like any business, They can do what they want with their resources. Also, like any business, they are always prioritizing profit. Under capitalism, that is their mandate. Until the U.S. government starts its own social media service, this is not an issue of free speech at all. This is an issue of capitalism. As with people who are upset about Amazon being so dominant, people upset with these social media companies are ultimately just complaining that these companies won at capitalism. Don't like it? Then go use a different social media network. Make your own. Or don't use any social media at all. It's funny that many of these same conservatives complaining about social media companies restricting their rights recently argued that bakeries can refuse to bake cakes for gay couples. I'd like to ask them, which is it? Should companies be allowed to choose how they operate or not? End quote. That's Joel in Rochester. Scott, on the money or is he missing some things?
Well, there are some limits that do apply. You know, for example, Facebook had been accused of housing discrimination based upon the kinds of ads that were running, saying, you know, if you're going to run ads directed at a certain group of people, and for folks to remember, the real issue with these companies is their skill and ability is hyper-directing information. So if I say I would like to find people in Penfield who love soccer and have two kids, you know, Facebook can do that. Other social media companies, they can serve that up. Versus traditional advertising, which might say, well, I can give you a billboard, you know, close to the soccer fields in Penfield. So we're talking about that's their business model, is really understanding and sucking in data about Evan, about Scott, and then targeting ads and other information at those folks. So one, you know, housing discrimination has been applied to Facebook and other companies. Fair business practices, data privacy rules have been applied and do apply. So they can't just do whatever they want, particularly the more data they take in or the more impact they have as companies, the more we use them for everyday services, the more they are going to be regulated. And then finally, of course, there are fair business practices. Every state, the federal government, have laws about fair business practices. And that can be a big catch-all for things that are very much weighted or unfairly done. Evan, I want to just point out three things. You and I talked about tips for folks that they can do, and I think this is a good example of what people should do.
Okay.
You know, the three things I was thinking about are, one, people should be intentional, skeptical, and conversational. Meaning, you know, as that email pointed out, be intentional. Why are you on this platform? You know, are you here just because you got 10 minutes, or is there something you want to do? Is there another platform to go to create competition or that can serve your intent better? Be skeptical. Is this information I'm being served, is it manipulating me? Again, I said ads are being served to you, you know. And then finally, be conversational. If you're going to post, say, would I say this face-to-face? Would I do this, you know, at a dinner party? You know, and I think those three things can really help folks out to navigate the world of social instead of just saying, oh, these big tech companies.
Yeah, that last one, that conversational one, I'm sure my tone gets a little more acerbic than I would be in person at times. I don't like that about myself. I try to check it as much as I can.
That's rarely true of you online, Evan. A lot of folks like what you say.
Well, I have my moments. And here's our friend Mike Johansson with his thoughts on this. He says, as to social media companies picking and choosing what gets shared, they are not public utilities, as some would suggest, but private platforms entitled to do as they will. There are concerns about Section 230 and the threat of legislation to modify it and potentially destroy their business models is quite legitimate and possibly driving some overzealous censorship these days. If both sides of the political aisle are clamoring for controls on social media platforms, I'm thinking they may be getting it mostly right. That's from Mike. What do you think, Scott?
Yeah, you know, as always, Mike has a really interesting and helpful perspective. You know, I think I kind of like the way it currently works. And the only reason, and there are many reasons, but a big one being flexibility. I think as things come up, like the Hunter Biden story, we saw Twitter really was moving quickly to try and change that. And I think you have to put the tools in the hands of the companies and say, you're going to have new uses, you got to be flexible, and please find a way to do it. But also, be transparent. Explain to us why you did things and how you did it. Traditionally, the companies haven't been as transparent as they could be. And obviously, I think one of the things they fear is people gaming the system. But coming from the legal world, you know, if you get a court decision, the decision explains these were the facts, this is the law I've applied, this is what should happen here. There may be some dicta in there about issues that weren't presented. And then the next case is easier to decide because people look at the other case. And that's how, you know, the case law works. You end up with hundreds of years of that. And I think the social media companies, they don't have hundreds of years, but they should have a better explanation of why something was up or down. And when they do that, I think you get better results overall.
Alexandra writes to the show that, and says, what is ethical? The point behind this is that Trump is advising people to do things that are unhealthy or untested to themselves, and this is not presidential behavior. That's from Alexandra. Scott Maloof.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the ethical question is a good one, but it all depends on how you frame things. You know, when we go back to where we started, who is this company to decide that they're going to take everything down or keep things up? You know, for example, when we saw the rioting earlier in the year, folks were posting, well, don't worry about it, these businesses have insurance. And I can tell you that's a really complicated question. Does that particular small business have insurance? They may or may not. Does the insurance cover what occurred in the riot? Maybe, maybe not. Depends on the state, depends on the policy. Are the contents of the store taken, you know, that were taken, covered? Maybe not. You know, and we can go on and on. So I think the question becomes, we have to ask ourselves, it's easy to say, well, I want this one particular thing taken down, moderated, censored. But when you start doing that en masse, you're going to end up with so much taken down that maybe the platform isn't useful anymore. The other thing is, remember, you know, we're doing this in an international context. If we decide that so much can come down, other parts of the world that don't have the First Amendment as kind of a moral suasion, that don't have a long tradition of free speech, are going to take down even more. And then repressive regimes or dictators are going to take down yet again even more.
Yeah.
So you're giving a cover to people. Whereas the other thing is we're kind of ignoring the problem. We need to have really good literacy of folks who are absorbing this material. I say it every time I'm on your show. Start your internet consumption with standard resources where you know where their office is. You know, use the DNC app, use the XXI app, because you know who those reporters are and where that information is coming from, as opposed to, oh, I'm going to get my news from Facebook.
Yeah, and I'm with you there. I think the idea that we want more posts taken down, blocked, or censored, whether it's Jack Dorsey's or Mark Zuckerberg's ideas or the government's, generally speaking, I am very much against that for a lot of the reasons we've been discussing. But I want to hit a couple of other points that listeners have about sort of Facebook jail. I'll get Michael's email in a second. I want to get Roy in Rochester on the phone now with Scott Maloof. Go ahead, Roy.
Hi. Yeah, if only because this just happened and you happened to have come up with a show around it. Yeah, I was in a Facebook group, Dead Memories Portland, about Portland, Oregon. So, and people share their memories, like what it was like to get to Hung Farlow's way late at night and go have Singapore Slings, and God, we missed that place, or the Oyster Bar, or, you know, what Neil Goldschmidt was like when he used to ride his bike to work back in the 70s. I wrote on October 25th about John Reed, first American buried in the Kremlin, author of 10 Days That Shook the World, about on the 103rd anniversary of the Russian Revolution. I got responses that, really? Was there such a guy? Was he named after Reed College? No, he wasn't. And then I got a monitor who said, I'm taking this all down. I'm not sure exactly what it was that they didn't state any particular reason.
And you want to know how they make those rules?
Yeah.
Fair enough. Scott Maloof, how do they make those rules?
Okay. So it's a bit difficult to know everything without seeing the links. I always say to people when they say, what can I do or can this come down? I say, send me the links, but we'll do this on the fly. My guess is the group has will have an admin or multiple administrators, and those are the people who decide what's going to happen in a group. So, for example, I'm in a couple different lawyer groups. I can't post about my services are great or here's, you know, buy this kind of insurance. The admin may have decided for some reason, you know, I think this needs to come down. So Facebook itself didn't even make that decision. If you got an automated notice from Facebook, that might be more likely Facebook made the decision as opposed to the admin. And it's a great example of you see things come down and you don't get an explanation. And the person, you know, even assuming good faith, they're making a decision on a gut. Is it, oh, you're off topic? Is it, I don't think this is helpful or it's inflammatory? But great example of the real world challenges.
All right. Well,
Roy.
Yeah, Roy, I hope that helps. And let me get Michael's email on kind of a maybe somewhat related, but this time he's calling it Facebook jail. So Michael says, my experiences, the experiences of my friends, has shown me that the Facebook police have a pro-Trump bias. I have been in Facebook jail 4 times for anti-Trump posts. I have reported Trumpsters for threatening violence and was told that it didn't violate their community standards. I mentioned Melania and a slur once and was told that violated their community standards, but wanting to shoot immigrant caravans does not. It's from Michael. Let me ask you about that. What would you say to Michael who says he's been in Facebook jail? I think that just means a suspension from the platform.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks that there's a bias there. The evidence I've seen indicates that there isn't. Let me see if I can pull up a note here. I don't think based on research that there's been found to be a bias on these various platforms, but I don't know. Scott, what do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right in quoting the research. Most research studies that I've seen or at least read about say, there is no bias. You know, and this is actually a really good example where Mark Zuckerberg has kind of gone, you know, back and forth both ways, and folks then impute his statements and say, okay, does that mean these particular posts I put up are being, you know, taken down because he's got a pro-Trumpian bias? It's really difficult because, again, it's opaque and it's hard to determine it. Oftentimes, you're not going to get an explanation that says, well, you used this word or we interpreted it this way. You may get something that says, well, these 5 reasons might have occurred. And if you delete the post, you can go back or, you know, we'll end your suspension in 24 hours. So it's really difficult. But, again, go back to the studies. I think most have said, you know, generally there's not. But go back to where I started. We're talking about posts, we're talking about ads, we're talking about groups. It's really, really difficult to do this, you know, and aggregate all those and say this platform is one thing or the other.
Yeah, the one thing that I think is fair to that drives some questions is what are the most shared videos and stories on Facebook over the last month? 7 out of 10 are videos from a guy named Dan Bongino. Now, if listeners are going, who? 7 out of 10 of the most popular Facebook posts are from some dude I've never heard of? Dan Bongino is a former New York police officer and a former Secret Service agent. He is a former Republican candidate for Congress. He did not win. He's a Republican commentator and a contributor to Fox News. And he routinely says that his goal is to own the libs. That's his goal. And he makes videos. And he is extremely popular with parts of the political right. And so if 7 out of 10 of the most popular Facebook videos on Facebook right now are that guy, is that evidence of anything other than sort of the velocity with which trolling gets shared, or is it something else, Scott?
Well, I mean, again, I kind of go back to if his posts don't violate the particular rules, if he hasn't paid for the posts to be elevated, if there is no coordinated inauthentic activity, what does that mean? That means he hasn't gathered 100 people and said, you know, I'm going to pay you or I'm going to incentivize you to like these posts because we want to make them accelerate and go really popular. Then, yeah, it may just be an example of someone who, of the moment, you know, has really captured the imagination. You know, and I don't think that's, you know, really helpful because, again, if we think about the Internet and we think about how we use it, you know, we can probably go back 5 years and find somebody else. And if we're going to go forward, we'll find something else. Right now, we talk a lot about TikTok, right? TikTok didn't even exist, you know, 10 years ago, mm-hmm. and yet now it's quite influential, you know. Or Twitch, which is where a lot of people watch others play games, or Reddit. I mean, there's so many other things. So I think we have to remember, you know, and I always say this when I speak, your internet is not their internet, you know, meaning just because you see something and do something, that's not how the other person is experiencing it or how they're going to view it.
Well, hey, we're late for a break. And Scott Maloof, we have so much other stuff to talk about. I mean, our listeners have derailed us here with some really good questions about how these platforms are operating, what they're choosing to ban or suspend over, mm-hmm. what politicians are saying. But we got a lot more to talk about with Scott Maloof, so let's get that only break, and we'll come right back. We're talking privacy. We're talking pictures and videos in public. We're talking about students and whether technology and apps can track your movement to make sure that we can contact trace for COVID, and a lot more with Scott Maloof next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, an attorney who worked on the Bush-Gore legal fight for the presidency in 2000 joins us, talking about what has changed in 20 years and what a legal fight for the presidency might entail this time around. In our second hour, Rochester Superintendent Dr. Leslie Meyer Small joins us. Rochester Teachers Association President Adam Urbanski joins us. We're talking about whether Rochester might go back to the classroom Friday. Talking to Scott Maloof, who is an attorney whose practice is focused on the intersection of social media and the law. He helps companies understand their own social media policies, works on individual cases, and helps us understand trends and legal questions that are out there. And I want to shift our focus to a couple of subjects that have been really pressing lately. First, I want to start with privacy and tracking how we might or might not get tracked. And I was telling Scott on the phone yesterday what I'll mention to listeners now, which is if you go back to April, you know, March, April in the pandemic, and we were looking at exploding case numbers in the United States, while China's numbers are more debatable, but, you know, clearly they didn't have a national shutdown pandemic. I mean, they certainly controlled it. I don't necessarily trust all of the numbers from China, but they controlled it. Korea, I do. South Korea was remarkable in what they did. And a friend of mine who has been in South Korea said, it's never going to happen here that way, because in South Korea, they do things differently, and they are willing, just as they are in a number of Asian countries, to use technology to allow for tracking of your movements. So they can almost immediately contact trace if you end up diagnosed with COVID. They can see where you've been, who you might have exposed otherwise. It's not going to take hours or days or weeks to do that. They can use tech to do it, and most people are on board with that. And that friend said to me in April, that's just not going to happen here. Well, there are questions about, for college students in particular, but otherwise, whether we could see that here. Is it okay if colleges say, hey, we want access to your app. We want you to download this app, which will tell us X, Y, Z. We want to be able to track movement. Scott, how do you see this landscape evolving, if at all, in this country, either on college campuses or just society-wide?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I think if you think about privacy, you know, that we all have, we say we want privacy. We say, oh, I'm not going to do it. But then convenience comes knocking, and we always open the convenience door. I'll give you a great example. When EasyPass first came in, right, folks are like, oh, my gosh, you know, those divorce attorneys are going to be able to subpoena and get EasyPass records. People will know, you know, how fast you're going. You know, now the toll takers are, for the most part, I believe, gone. And the anticipation is you'll have EasyPass or images of your license plate will be used and you'll get a bill. You know, and nary a peep on that issue. And I think we're going to see the same thing, right? We have cashless payments. And if you start thinking about it, well, how would a cashless payment work? It's got to verify it's you. It's got to verify you're at the location and that you had the transaction. You know, that's way more information than just handing somebody a 20. So I think people raise the objection and then they very quickly back away.
Okay. So it doesn't sound like you think that we're, well, I mean, it sounds like you think that what is objectionable becomes normal pretty quickly, but we haven't necessarily seen it to the level that we've seen it in Asian countries.
No, I agree. And I think, you know, part of that is there is right now, we're still at the situation where we say, okay, do I want to download an app? And we still do have skepticism as to whether it's going to work. And so, you know, again, it's going to come to, you know, right now we're seeing some spiking. And if you said to folks, well, you're going to trade this app for more freedom, folks may be willing to do that. I mean, it's really hard, right, because the situation is so dynamic.
What about college students being told by their professors, or what about employees being told by their employers, mm-hmm. when we have a Zoom meeting, your camera must be on?
Yeah, that's a really good one. I think for employees it's a bit easier. I think if it's something when it gets to sort of off-duty time, you know, if the employers say we're just checking in and it was outside the employee's normal work hours, that may be a little bit harder. During work, you know, and you know, then I think the employer has a little bit greater of the ability to say, well, I want to see you, I want to make sure you're doing things. What I would layer in, though, is a lot of the traditional laws that we've talked about, like National Labor Relations Act, which allows employees to, you know, communicate among the terms of their employment. If the employer were using that in some way to, you know, keep the employees from coordinating with each other for safety purposes, such as, you know, do we have PPE when we're in there, that would be a problem. If the employer were recording that information and then keeping it, and so now they have a background of the employee's home, they have pictures of the employee's kids, and they didn't have a good records policy, that also may be a violation of some of the expectations or duties they have. It's going to depend on the state. It's going to depend on kind of how much is in there. Students are in a bit of a different place because I think what they're seeing more is the university, you know, kind of gatekeeping their presence on campus, you know, using an app or you know, go back to your question, you know, the professor having some discretion. And, you know, I think a lot of students would rightfully push back and say, you know what, I don't think this is necessary. If you're trying to figure out if I've watched the class or something, you can find a better way to do it. You might put an Easter egg, you know, a particular announcement in the middle of it. You don't need to see my background, especially when I have all these other people there. And I think it could be a real problem for schools if they demand it. I know I've got friends who are educators and on the lower levels, and they say, you know what, if a kid doesn't want to turn the camera on, if it's not really, really necessary, you know, I may not want to, especially in a one-on-one discussion.
James writes to say, when it comes to tracking, you are advocating for the Orwellian state. Unbelievable. James, I'm not advocating for an Orwellian state. I haven't shared my opinion on this at all. And I haven't even heard Scott share his opinion. He shared the broader context, which is that we have a tendency in our country to resist changes that seem to infringe on some privacy at first and then adapt to them if they seem, you know, sort of tolerable or wise or beneficial in other ways. He's not saying we should definitely do it. I'm certainly not saying we should definitely. I think we should be skeptical of anything that infringes on our privacy. And I think we should ask questions and then come to those decisions together. And then you can decide if this is Orwellian. You could decide if it's logical in a pandemic. I'm not advocating either way. I do think skepticism is warranted. I think it's fair to say, whoa, before you make me download this app, why? What is it? How is it used? What's the function of it? What are its limits? I think those are good questions. Scott, do you?
Yeah, and I'm glad James brings it up because I think what you're really trying to do is you're trying to say, okay, if I'm going to push back, it's not just to say this has, you know, some kind of characteristics. You know, let's say calling it Orwellian, what you really want to say is, okay, what exactly is going on here? So let's say it's an app that tracks my location, right, to be a student at a college, okay? How are you tracking that location? Are you using GPS to track me? So when I leave campus, let's say I go shopping or something, the school knows that, or are you just tracking me on campus? How long do you keep that data? You know, if I have no indications of COVID, if I'm taking a COVID test and I'm COVID-free, do you delete everything from the last 2 weeks because you won't then need it for tracking? I mean, here's what I'd say. It's great to push back, and I agree you should always be asking, you know, do I need this, both on an individual level and a systemic level? But the best way to do that is to say, what's kept? Why are you keeping it? Where are you keeping it? You know, a good example is looking at education. We're seeing all these new apps come into schools, and they're third-party platforms. You know, and the question would be, okay, school, how have you vetted this? Where is this data stored? And then how is this data going to be deleted? And do you have the ability to force them to do something? If it's a company in Washington State, okay, that may be doable. If it's a company across the world in some other jurisdiction, that may be much more difficult. So that's what I'm saying. We have to really look at this. Same thing, like look at credit cards. Almost all of us use credit cards. That creates a trail, right? And we don't even think about it. You know, if you really were opposed to that kind of trail, you'd say, okay, I'm only going to use cash, or I'm only going to shop at merchants who, you know, tell me this is how they're going to use that data. Mm-hmm. Or I'd use, you know, prepaid cards. So it's really, you got to get granular to help make that really work.
I want to ask you about one more issue before we lose the hour, and that is also on the subject of privacy in public. We, of course, have seen a number of public protests and demonstrations. No doubt there will be many more to come in the coming months here in this country for a number of reasons. I mean, for social issues, the election and going in any direction could lead to protests. I'm not just talking about one direction. So we're going to see more of it. And there's this trend that a guy by the name of Tim Lee was writing about on Twitter, this trend that people who go to public events or in public places will then say to someone else, often a journalist, hey, you can't take my picture. You can't take video of this. Tim wrote on Twitter, quote, I would like to read a good explainer on the emerging norm against taking pictures of people in public places without permission. It seems to have gotten a lot stronger in the last few years. Just now I was standing in a park reading my phone, and a woman in my phone's field of view wrongly decided I was taking pictures. She walked over and angrily told me to stop. Another guy called out to me, you can't take people's pictures without permission. That's Tim Lee on Twitter. I am just as confused as he is. Yes, you can take people's pictures in public. You can take pictures in public. You can take video in public. You don't need people's permission. And I'm okay with having conversations with people. If someone says to me, hey, you've got 1,000 options for taking pictures of this protest, I'm a little uncomfortable because of XYZ, I will listen. But, we don't give editorial decision-making to people who show up to protest. I mean, if you're at a protest, it could be documented. I don't understand it very well at all. Scott, do you?
I know that norm has somewhat emerged, and I agree with you. I don't think it's helpful. I don't think it really makes sense. And let's break it down. There are two things that, to me, at issue here, the taking of a photo or video and the use of it, right? And so taking of it, we've pretty much all, for a long time, said, in public spaces, it's okay. Right? And then in more private spaces, no, not so. So, for example, we've criminalized putting cameras in changing rooms or using that kind of stuff. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the use in public. And then secondly, it's the use after the taking of it. Is it okay to use it? And again, that goes right to the First Amendment. I think we've all agreed. It's reporting. It's public. If we think about a lot of the discussions we're having now, right, particularly around issues of how police are treating folks, it grows out of videos that people were able to take. Do we think we'd be in a better place if an officer said, you know, you can't take my picture, you can't record this? In fact, a lot of the federal circuits have come down and said, no, folks absolutely have a First Amendment right to record law enforcement officers while they're conducting official duties. So I don't think the norm is helpful, you know, and I don't think it's really particularly well thought through. But, Evan, historically, there's an interesting point that links to us, that when Kodak cameras first came out, you know, and they made picture-taking much easier and cheaper, there was a ton of pushback from people. You know, people called it deadly Kodak. And Justice Louis Brandeis, who eventually got on the Supreme Court, wrote a law review all about privacy and how a lot of these new technologies, like the Kodak camera, were invading spaces. And so we've kind of, you know, gone around and full, you know, with that thing, because that was written in about 1890, mm-hmm. I want to say.
Well, last couple of minutes, Scott Maloof, you mentioned that you watched The Social Dilemma, which is a documentary on Netflix, right? Is it Netflix?
Yes, Netflix.
I haven't seen it yet. Do you recommend it?
I'll tell you two things. One, I recommend the last 10 minutes.
That's a hell of an endorsement.
I think it was difficult because in watching it, it was the interviews with people, it's basically they interview a lot of people who are at these technology companies early on, and the folks do a really good job of explaining how they built the companies, what they were doing, raising the ethics, you know. But again, similar to what you and I had discussed, it leaves out, you know, all the other influences that we have in our lives, you know, cable news, print media, family and friends, radio, all the other things that make it up. And it makes it sound like all we do all day is spend time on social. But I have to tell you, Evan, so I was watching it in the kitchen, And at one point, one of the speakers was saying, we designed these tools to distract you and to suck in all your attention. And I was so fascinated. All of a sudden, I thought, oh, my God, my cinnamon buns are burning. And so I ran over, and I had to pull them out of the oven. So, I mean, the program is really helpful to tell you what's going on because it distracted me and almost made me burn those.
Okay, well, I'm all for continued media literacy, especially understanding some of the people and the ideas behind the scenes, the ways that these companies try to get us addicted, try to get us coming back and spending more and more time there. I do think that's valuable.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And as I recommend the last 10 minutes because there were a lot of tips from these very folks who designed these platforms to be addictive. You know, and one of the big ones they said was, turn off the notifications.
I love that.
Yeah. Another one, delete or disable apps. You know, we talked about tracking. We talk about, you know, big government. Get rid of the app if you don't need it.
Turning off notifications is so good. So good. Listeners, I did that on a number of apps, and it's a little more freeing. And I know people who know me might say, baloney. But it is. Scott Maloof, always good. ScottMaloof.com, an attorney whose practice focuses on the intersection of social media and the law. Thanks for the expertise. It's going to be a wild next week or so, but there's going to be a lot to see on these subjects. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having me, Evan. Always great.
Always appreciate that. And always appreciate the whole team here. Rob Braden is the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Kind of crummy out there. Hope you're warm and cozy and having a good afternoon, and we will talk to you Friday on member-supported public radio.